Welcome again. So we'll proceed from here with the first part of this talk, which I'll give. I'd like to start by sharing my screen, or sharing a particular document here. Let's see if I can get this to work. Can you see this? Oh, well, this isn't the one I wanted. There. Can you see this list of the paramis? Someone give me a thumbs up. Yeah. Great. I thought it might be nice to just have this on the screen for when we're, while we're talking through some broad strokes about what we're going to do today. So I mentioned earlier, the paramis are qualities of the heart. And my goodness, there are 10 of them. And we have so little time here together. When I first thought of doing this talk, actually, I was thinking, oh, gee, how are we going to talk about 10 things? How am I going to do 5 of these in a 20-minute talk and Jerry do another 5 in 20 minutes? You know, and it's easy to think, oh, my God, there are all these things I need to do. I need to be generous, moral. I need to renunciate. I need to develop wisdom, energy, patience, truthfulness, resolution, loving kindness, equanimity. Oh, my goodness. And, you know, you can be self-punishing when you look at these things. You can feel like, you know, you must perfect yourself by developing all of these. But I want to start with this idea that this isn't a list of things that are wrong with us, that we must do better at. You know, and in fact, you know, several teachers write that all you really need to do to develop these qualities, these things that are called perfections, is to see clearly, is to be mindful. And all of the paramis flow naturally from that. So let's give ourselves a break at the very beginning and know that this isn't a to-do list. These aren't things we must do for ourselves and cultivate in order to be good people. All we really need to do is see clearly, and these will come. So then why study these? So I mentioned that these are perfections of the heart. They're where we're headed in some sense. And if not where we are right now. So spending time thinking about these is kind of like seeing the light in the distance that we're heading towards. Seeing them helps point us. It helps orient us. Imagining what a perfection is like puts us on the path in an easier way to get there. There's also this idea, you know, have you heard the phrase fake it till you make it? You know, there's that logic here. You know, by making yourself do something before it happens naturally, before it's actually our state of being, we can actually cause it to become more natural. We can actually move ourselves in that direction. You know, you can think of how a smile, you know, actually just raising the corners of our mouth, actually activates the parasympathetic nervous system. It makes us happier by smiling. We're kind of wagging the dog when we do that, but it works. So in that same way, we can actually see more clearly, we can become more mindful by behaving in the ways that a mindful person does, by behaving according to the paramis. So Sylvia Borstein writes, each heart quality is both inspired by wisdom and the cause of wisdom, right? And I think she's getting at something similar here. This is a two-way path. Through seeing clearly, through mindfulness, we develop these perfections, these qualities you see on the screen. But also, by just looking at these qualities and nurturing these qualities, we develop mindfulness. We can go that way. Some of you may have heard reference to the path of compassion. And the idea is that rather than starting with mindfulness, starting with this practice that most of us have, right? Most of us begin with this mindfulness, this seeing clearly, this awareness. We can start by being compassionate. We can start just by loving. And from there, open into all the rest of us, right? That's the path of compassion. We don't need to begin with mindfulness. It's this two-way street that Sylvia Boorstein was referring to. So I think that's wonderful. To me, when I hear that, it's sort of a relief. Oh, there's so many ways to get at this. I don't need to choose just one. And I can kind of open into those things that maybe feel most natural to me. All of those, you know, that I can open into the paramis and go to mindfulness, open into mindfulness, go to the paramis. There's even more good news, which is that not only is this a feedback system into mindfulness, but all of these paramis are openings into each other. When we cultivate generosity, morality, renunciation, we naturally open into the others, wisdom, energy, patience, truthfulness, etc. And it works the other way too. So this is a particularly wonderful talk for wonderful fact for a talk like today, where we have so few minutes to discuss these things, because you don't need to hold in all of this. My suggestion to you, in fact, is to just hear and feel the paramis as we say them today, and connect with, get a felt sense of them, and connect with what resonates with you. If you hear one that's really just, it's strong with you, or it feels like a path, start there. By nurturing that one parami, we open into all the others naturally, right? Okay, I'll go through these, and my goodness, I think it's gonna feel like a lightning, like a storm. I'm going to start with these ones. Generosity, from generosity to renunciation, which I feel is related. From renunciation, I'm going to touch equanimity. It's often discussed later in this list of paramis, but I feel they're related, and I feel like we can lump the three together. So generosity, renunciation, equanimity. Then I'll move to ethics, also discussed as morality or virtue. From there, I'll go to metta, loving kindness, goodwill. Okay, let's begin. Generosity. Close your eyes and hear that word for a moment. Feel what it makes you feel. Yeah. So there's a story where James Beres and Sylvia Boorstein went to meet with an Advaita Vedanta teacher. His name was H.W.L. Punja. And, you know, they sat on retreat with him. And, you know, at the end, they were invited to a private audience with him. And he asked them what they did. They said, well, we teach mindfulness and we teach loving kindness. And we especially emphasize generosity. And he said, there is no such thing as generosity. There is only the awareness of need and the natural impulse to address it. If you're hungry and a hand puts food in your mouth, you don't think of a hand as generous, do you? So they were kind of stunned by this, you know, this, there is no such thing as generosity. What? And, you know, I don't think he actually means this literally, but if you contemplate this idea that we don't think of the hand as generous when it brings food to our mouth, there's a delightful sense of connection in that. Imagine, like, what if we saw all of ourselves as part of the same organism, and giving, being generous, was as uncomplicated and as easy as having our hands put food in our mouths, right? Just think of that. So I think he's pointing to that, but he's also pointing to the fact that generosity, when perfectly expressed, doesn't feel like anything. It's just natural. Can you imagine a state where we have no attachment to these things that we possess, and giving them is just like moving them where they need to be, right? So in this way, generosity offers some insight into non-self, to non-identification, right? You can kind of feel that in the sense that he gives. So what's in the way of that? What gets in the way of generosity? Before we experience generosity, the actual desire to give something away, we need to experience not needing. that thing, right? There's the freedom in that sense of not needing. And if you're like me, you know, you might be thinking, yeah, but I am needy, right? We do feel like we need these things. I mean, try thinking about how much stuff you have that you really need and imagine giving away the rest, right? It's hard. It's a really hard thing to imagine doing. You know, most of us feel generous when we're feeling comfortable, when we're in a place of abundance, or when we recognize a very strong need in someone else, perhaps. Here's the thing, though. If we do feel need, and we are generous nonetheless, we get to touch that feeling of not needing. We get to recognize that after that act of giving, which felt maybe difficult, we are still whole. We don't often even miss the thing that we gave away, right? So this generosity puts us in touch with this natural sense of abundance. We can experience the feeling not needy. And it's kind of that feedback loop we talked about at the beginning. We do the thing, we're faking it till we make it, in a sense. We do the generosity and we actually start to cultivate those preconditions for that natural sense of generosity that that Punjaji was referring to. Okay, my goodness, so little time. Practices with generosity. There's a simple, try to find an opportunity to be generous. Try it once in a week, maybe increase from there. See how it feels with you. You can do a meditation. There's a meditation that's specifically about giving away everything beside the breath. So ultimately, it's a breath meditation, but there's a felt sense that's different. When something else arises besides the breath, we give it away. We can also contemplate, what is it that you could give away? Right? Just contemplate. So flowing naturally from generosity is renunciation. So these two are related to me. Generosity is giving things you have to others. Renunciation is this willingness to shed or let go of what we have. Right? Like generosity, it flows out of a state where we don't identify those things with ourselves. We aren't in this tight space of scarcity or clinging to the things we have that don't serve us. There are a few additional things about renunciation, though, that I think are worth mentioning. While we may associate it, you know, for me, I naturally associate it with giving up material goods, like, you know, giving up candy for Lent or something like that. We can apply it equally to shedding the lives that don't serve. Shedding the parts of ourselves we don't need, the things that need to be given up. This is what the Buddha did, right? He was born a prince and realized that that wasn't the life that would serve him. He renounced. He started that life of contemplation. It was a life that didn't serve him. We can turn to the question to ourselves. What parts of you, what beliefs about yourself, what identities that you carry don't serve you? There's one other thing about renunciation I'd like to mention before we move. It's that we don't just apply it to shedding, to getting rid of things. We also apply that notion to restraining ourselves from grasping. Renunciation is also this restraint we place upon ourselves. So that is, you know, not scrolling down the social media feed forever, right? That's restraint. It takes restraint. Not seeking out more than we need. That's restraint. That kind of restraint flows naturally when we recognize that the grasping we'll be doing creates far more suffering than the momentary discomfort of restraint. Right? That's what needs to happen for that to become natural. And then there are all these positives that spring out of a life in which we've resisted the temptation to grasp. Sylvia Borstein again describes this as bringing the relief of modulated desires. There's a relief to not having the need for all these things. There's also a gaining of appreciation for what we have. And we can practice that restraint. One practice option in meditation is starting a meditation with a specific intention, like, I'll just feel my belly rising. I'll just feel the palms of my hands. And notice when your mind wants to move. You feel the impulse to move and do something else, focus on something else. Renounce it. And let the feeling of that restraint in. Just get familiar with that feeling of restraint. It's a way of practicing this. Equanimity is tied to both generosity and renunciation. This is the third one I'm talking, at least it's the third in my list. Equanimity, right? It's this holding of everything, this complete openness to all experiences. Pain, love, appreciation, all at once. It's also this acceptance of impermanence, right? Each of these experiences comes and goes. We're not clinging to each positive moment. We're not ruminating on every negative one. We observe and we move on. That's the feeling of equanimity. That's the felt sense of it. You can see how a mind with equanimity becomes naturally generous and naturally willing to renounce. That's the tie-in. We aren't clinging to our experiences. When we're letting them go, we naturally can move into the releasing of our clinging to possessions and identities. We become able to give and to shed. Moving on. Ethics. Ethics, along with renunciation and generosity, is one of the foundations. It's considered one of the foundational parts. In some sense, ethics are an extension of generosity. You know, with generosity, we're giving to others, right? With ethics, we're taking wise action and wise speech with regard to others, right? In both senses, we're doing a kindness. So to get in touch with ethics, many of us have regrets that we carry with us and remember, right? No matter how many years have passed. And for me, and I suspect many of us here, those regrets, those things that stick with us over time, are tied to ethical mistakes we made. So we can sense the fact that ethical behavior saves us this pain. It saves us the pain we and others feel when we cause suffering that can last for so many years. We live free of guilt, and we also give others safety. The Buddha gave this advice on ethics. He asked us to consider, is what I am about to do for my own well-being and the benefit of all others? Is what I am currently doing for my own well-being and for the benefit of others? Is what I just did for my own benefit and for the benefit of others? He's pointing to the fact that every action and inaction also has these consequences. They're all worthy of consideration. Of course, in practice, you know, we can't litigate every action we take, right? We can't go about, you know, every single thing I do, I can't think, is this the right thing to do? But very often we have a sense, don't we, about when we're about to do something that requires a pause. We can listen to that sense. That sense is grown by our mindfulness practice, right? We become more attuned to the feeling in our body when we're about to do something questionable. You know, we're aware of that uncomfortable sensation. So mindfulness helps us not have to litigate every action, right? We can start to pay attention to that feeling and say, wait, is this a moment when we need to take a pause? Another factor that helps when it comes to ethics is calmness. Thought of another way, we're more likely to commit an ethical mistake when we're agitated. Maybe we're in an uncomfortable environment. Maybe we're trying to prove ourselves or just fit in. You know, if I think of the things I regret, those are often the circumstances that surround it. So what can we do in practice? We can just take a pause and breathe, right? There's also a virtuous cycle at play here. The more we act in line with our ethics, the more naturally calm we are. We're not in a fight with ourselves, right? And the more calm we are, in turn, the easier it is to remain ethical, right? We're finding ourselves less agitated, less caught up in a situation. There's a story here I want to tell, but I know we're running out of time. Perhaps I'll skip over this and bring up these things if they come up in discussion so that we have time for everything else and time for discussion. I'll mention one more thing about ethics, are the practices. Right. One is developing calmness. We can do this again with breath meditation. The Buddha recommended, as I breathe in, I am calmed. As I breathe out, I am calmed. That's something we can practice to just develop and cultivate that sense of kindness. Another is to meditate on the precepts. I'll read them very quickly. The precepts are, I vow to abstain from harming living beings, right? These are, many of us have heard these, but if you haven't, I'll read these and also to remind. I vow to abstain from taking what is not freely given. I vow to abstain from sexual misconduct. I vow to abstain from incorrect speech, right? Hurtful speech. I vow to abstain from intoxicants that lead to heedlessness. I feel like that last one always needs some qualification. I don't think anyone will begrudge you your glass of wine. I think when I think of that, I think the main thing here is not to put ourselves into a situation where we have no control of how we act. We have no control of how we may do harm to others, where we're unable to be calm, unable to pause, unable to think what is the right action to take. Oh goodness, I have one more, Jerry. I hope it's okay. I'll try and do this quickly. It is metta. So please close your eyes for a moment and listen to these words about metta. Let's just get the felt sense. Open-heartedness. Love. Willing to love ourselves and others. Forgiveness. Forgiving ourselves and others. Compassion. This love we feel for those in need. So why practice metta? Simply, we all want to love and be loved. Loving kindness makes us happy. What gets in the way here is when we're fearful. When we're fearful, it's harder to love. And we or others are not forgiven in our hearts, it's harder to love. We can also come preconditioned with the idea that strength is about hardening, not recognizing that love can be strong and fierce. So maybe I'll just end with a quote about how love can be strong and fierce. It's from Martin Luther King in one of his speeches. He said, we shall match your capacity to inflict suffering by our capacity to endure suffering. We shall meet your physical force with soul force, with love. We will not hate you, but we cannot in all good conscience obey your unjust laws. And we will soon wear you down with our capacity to suffer and with our love. And winning our freedom We will so appeal to your heart and conscience that we will win your freedom as well. So again, we're going very quickly through these. All we can do in a time like this is sense whether any of these appeals to you, whether any of these is calling to you as something to cultivate, and just start there.